Ashtrees?
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's February 24th, 2014, and we have two bills to work session. I would like to open the work session on House Bill 4013. Sandy, bring us up to date on where we are on 4013.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4013, the underlying bill authorizes practitioners to electronically transmit prescriptions for Schedule II controlled substances in non-emergency situation. It declares an emergency effective on passage. You have a dash 3 amendment that is addressing step therapy. I will let, if the committee does not mind, Senator Steiner Hayward, she put the group together for a consensus amendment, and she can give the committee the background. But before she does that, I want you to know that there's minimal impact on the dash 3 amendment and no revenue impact on the dash 3 amendment.
First of all, before she says it, I want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for doing this Friday afternoon. I know that the proponents of the amendment were wandering around the house halls saying, Do you know anything? And then Senator Steiner Hayward let me know that there was consensus, and I was glad to see that. So please go forward and explain the dash A threes. Just the threes. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you may recall, when we last met on Thursday, I explained what had been going on with 4013 with the step therapy amendment. And at that point, I said I'd had the opportunity to have a preliminary conversation with the director of pharmacy for Care Oregon, and there was a proposal for a way to reword the sections 5 and 6 sub 2C clause to change it a little bit to say documentation related to a specific patient rather than specific documentation, which would allow variability based on the needs of individual patients, which made a lot of sense to me. I then had the opportunity to speak with three other folks from Southern Oregon, members of representatives of CCOs represented by COHO, who are part of COHO, the Community Coalition for Healthy Oregon, and went over, first of all, the proposed change to that particular clause, which they were supportive of, and then went over their concerns a little bit further. And once we had the opportunity to do that, I then sent them an email, which went over it. And there's a couple of things that came up in that conversation that I think are important to clarify, if I may, Madam Chair. The first is that according to OAR, CCOs are basically already required to do this. I explained to them that the reason that we were doing this, that we were including them in this statutory change, is that we thought it was important to make a clear statement that Medicaid patients and doctors serving Medicaid patients, providers serving Medicaid patients, had to follow the same, had the same opportunities to work with their providers as people with commercial insurers. Okay. The second is that we understand that the vast majority of plans, and to our knowledge, all CCOs are already doing all this. However, we expect that this, we know that there are some plans that are not doing it well, unfortunately, and are making things confusing and inconsistent for providers and patients. So it's important to fix that problem. Finally, we don't expect that every insurer or CCO will put all of this stuff online, although many of them already do. We simply expect that when a provider is trying to work through a step therapy protocol, that the evidence for that protocol be clearly available, be easily understandable, be applied consistently, and that doctors and other providers who are trying to work patients through step therapy protocols have the opportunity to do so working with the same person and getting a clear sense of what's going on. So it's really just making sure that everybody's playing off the same sheet of music, that everybody's playing on a level playing field. And with all of that, making sure that we're getting consistency within a given plan. We understand that different plans may have different protocols, and that's fine as long as they apply their own protocols consistently. And once we'd gone over that, I sent an email out to all the relevant people after that confirming our conversation and have not heard any concerns back. I told them it was a speak now or forever hold your peace situation because we were going to be working this on Monday afternoon and have not heard back any concerns from any of them. So I think we've gotten to a point where everybody's comfortable with this amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward. I don't see any CCO representative come forward. You already said you were neutral, though, correct?
Correct, Madam Chair. Jessica Chambers for Care Oregon, and we are okay with the bill with the -3 amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 4013.
Did I open the work
session? Yes, you did.
Yes, I did.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendments into House Bill 4013. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, just briefly, Madam Chair, it's a step in the right direction. I still believe that a doctor should be able to do what he thinks in the patient's best interests with as little interference as possible.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Shields?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry that I was late. I know that family care was one of the ones who had concerns about this,
everybody's
or was
fine.
That a different bill?
No, everybody's fine. All the COHO people are fine. I spoke on the phone with somebody from family care, somebody from all care, and somebody from Trillium. And everybody's copacetic,
okay,
based on this amendment and the things that I said on the record, some of which you may have heard and some of which you might not have, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any opposition? Amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4013 as amended by the -3 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4013 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monsanto.
Aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, you're the chief sponsor. You should carry it.
Well, you know, I feel that Senator Steiner Hayward did such momentous work on this that she could carry it if you would like to do that.
I'd be honored, Madam Chair, but it's entirely up to you.
No, you can carry it, and I will.
Here, quick, you take it.
I will give my 2 cents worth on the floor.
Madam Chair,
your chief sponsor also.
Well, I know. I was going to say, as for all the fine work that Senator Steiner Hayward did, the underlying bill is a
really
massively
good
significant
huge
importance.
Bill. Absolutely. Absolutely. This was a great team effort here. So it's entirely up to you, Madam Chair, Mr.
No,
Vice Chair.
No, I guess it is our bill, the underlying bill is, but I think the most contentious issue was the amendment. And you did a yeoman's work on it to satisfy a lot of people.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Here. So I will say some words on the underlying bill, but you can carry
Thank
it.
You.
All right. All right. Clerk, call the roll. Well, we did that. Okay, now we can close the work session.
There you go.
On House Bill 4013. And Nikki, congratulations. All right, I'll open a work session on 4028A. Colleagues, I talked with the Representative Tomei on this, and we have decided not to go with the any amendment on this bill. And so we are in work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4028A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4013.
No.
4028. 4028. 4028. Oh, I got the wrong bill for me. 4028A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I respect your decision to not move any amendments, and I understand that there was some contention that didn't have a chance to be worked out. That being said, I think the underlying substance of the proposed amendment was really good, and I do think that we should be making sure that the lottery is basically the statute would have just reinforced what they're already going to be doing on policy, if I'm correct, Mr. Roberts. they were very comfortable with the proposed changes. I respect the fact that there was some confusion at this late date. It was probably hard to get through. But I think it's a good idea. It's a complicated decision to have a state lottery. We've made one. I'm fine with having one, but I also think that we need to be doing things to make sure that people are using it responsibly.
And I would concur, Senator Steiner Hayward. I was definitely in favor of the amendment as well as the base bill. I did hear from my colleagues that they felt that the amendment was not constitutional, and then we probably would have had a constitutional problem on the floor as well. I think that we have to really, because we have a lottery system, and there are very few people, but there are few people who have addiction issues. And we as a state need to, even though they made the choice to gamble, I still think that we as a state have the responsibility to make sure that we help those who do become addicted, whether it's alcohol and drug or gambling. Any other discussion? Yeah, Senator Knope.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in large part, though, the underlying bill will help us accomplish where we're trying to go. But beyond that, obviously concerns about relating clause issues and other things with the amendments. But beyond that, we clearly have both constitutionally and statutorily committed ourselves to funding certain things through the lottery. And so that, I think, needs to be done in a discussion along with the Ways and Means process and looking at where the lottery goes from here and how much it produces, because we know education and environmental stewardship and things like that are also tied to the lottery, amongst others. And so I think in the short session, it's pretty difficult for us to make a quick judgment on whether those amendments will, in fact, create issues down the road for funding for education and other things without, you know, without people who are on Ways and Means and others looking at it. And so I'm comfortable with a commitment from Commissioner Roberts that this is going to happen and that they're going to continue on a path of trying to keep problem gamblers or from getting addicted in the first place. And so with that, I'm comfortable with this bill the way it is.
Thank you, Senator Knope. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was willing to push the envelope with Representative Tomei as far as she could push it, but I do think that hopefully this is just the first step in taking a look at our own addiction to gambling in the state and how we use it to fund services. I think we need, it's right for us to try to strike the balance and that we not pursue as much money at all costs, no matter the price that everyday Oregonians should pay. It's a good first step, and I'll be happy to support it.
Thank you.
I have nothing to say.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Chip Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator
Knope.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Montana.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'd like to carry the bill. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 4028A. And colleagues,
I'm more important.
Senator Steiner Hayward has the floor, the dais right now. She will be reporting on the task force on the delivery of human services. That was Senate Bill 450.
She looks familiar.
Okay, I will open an informational meeting.
Madam Chair, is there a timer? Was it 2 minutes? I'm sorry.
I can do it in 2 minutes.
Awesome.
Madam Chair, I'm just glad she's giving that look to Senator Knope and not me.
It could head your direction.
I know that could happen there, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Planner Hayward, State Senator for District 17, here today to give a report on the progress of the task force established under Senate Bill 450 from the 2013 regular session. As you may recall, since this bill came through this committee, this task force was designed to pull together parties who are engaged with delivery of human services with the ultimate goal of figuring out ways to reduce barriers to streamlining delivery of those services so that people who need safety net services are not spending all their time navigating the system, but rather are spending time doing the things they need to do to get back on their feet to self-sufficiency. The task force has now had three meetings, and we are very fortunate to have Ms. Dealey Circa helping us out with that, as well as Barry Pack and others from DAS, who were charged with convening it. We have a broad representation, as outlined in the original bill, which you can refer to if you want. We had our first meeting, and at that one, we worked to define how to keep our mission narrow enough, because it would be very easy to expand this and have mission creep and get to the point where it's hard to keep ourselves on track and really getting something done. So the first decision we made, since my idea for this bill had come from a conference I attended called Opportunities for Working Families, is to really focus primarily on working families. We would certainly be engaged with some of the issues around the elderly or the disabled as they relate to families who have disabled family members or elderly family members as part of their family network that they're engaged with, but it's really targeted at working families, families who are trying to get themselves on the track to become solidly middle-class families, to be able to be self-sufficient and independent. So that was the first decision we made as a committee. The second was to decide as a committee, as a task force, how we were going to know whether an action we were proposing to take was consistent with our mission. And ultimately, we came up with two litmus tests for any thing that we were going to propose. We hope that anyone with these would propose would result would be in line with both of these, but one would be sufficient. The first of these was, does it improve the experience and efficiency for both the recipient and the government worker involved, i.e., does this make this faster, cleaner, and easier to navigate? Because frankly, our state employees who are helping deliver these services aren't having a good time with this either. They're spending an awful lot of time doing paperwork and not a lot of time doing casework. They're having to duplicate work that's already been done because our information systems don't talk with each other, things like that. And our recipients are spending more time navigating the system than getting back on their feet. So that's the first one. And the second was, does it reduce the time to self-sufficiency for recipients of safety net services? So that led us to the question of what does self-sufficiency mean, because we wanted to be sure that we were all talking about the same thing. And we had a rather thoughtful, engaged discussion and came up with a bunch of definitions, I think most of which should be fairly obvious. The first is to significantly reduce, if not eliminate, dependency on government safety net services. The second is to have the capacity for self-determination and the ability to navigate so that if, for example, one wanted to receive more education, one knew how to reach out to get the help you needed to get more education. And there are several others. I'm happy to submit the definition to the committee if you're so inclined. But suffice it to say that we came up with a definition that all of us could live with. So that takes us through the first meeting. We were busy. At the second meeting, we reviewed our definition of self-sufficiency, and we started to talk about barriers. And ultimately, we talked about barriers in four categories, the first of which is technologic. So I mentioned, for example, that our information systems don't talk with each other very well, and we have to enter demographic data on multiple occasions for the same recipient. The second is structural. And that has to do with where programs are located and how they connect with each other or don't connect with each other, how government workers are informed about the availability of other programs, things like that. The third is regulatory. So, for example, are there policies or OARs or statute on the state or federal level that prohibit us from doing the smart thing, right? A good example of that is
the policy, the fact that we get a lot of our money for child welfare from Title IV-E funding from the federal government. Unfortunately, that money only comes to us if a child is actually in foster care. So efforts to keep children in their own homes with the right support services and the right interventions to help them live in that home safely and in a nurturing environment are hamstrung by the fact that we don't get the money to do that, to provide services, unless we take the child out of the home, which is kind of counterproductive. There are other similar examples on the state level. And finally, the fourth, around which we have the least control, is environmental. For example, obviously, the economy. When we have the economy come in and tank the way it did in 2008, then obviously we enter this countercyclical period. So more people need social services, and yet there's less revenue to provide it for them, and there's more demand on our caseworkers, and yet we have less money to pay for caseworkers. So caseloads go up dramatically. And we have caseworkers who, by national standard, should be handling somewhere between 40 and 60 cases, managing upwards of 200, which makes it pretty darn tough for them to do what they need to do to help people get more sufficient on their own and get through the system faster. So basically what we did was we went around and we solicited input from all the members of the task force about examples of these barriers, and started to break them down. And DAS did a great job helping us by categorizing them a little bit, finding duplications and doing that. Finally, at our third meeting, we went into a lot more detail, talking about very specific examples of some of these barriers. The net result at this point is that we're starting to identify some patterns. The first is issues around confidentiality, because there are certainly rules and there are also belief sets about confidentiality that may not actually be true. The second is housing, because obviously having a clean, safe place to live is a fundamental underpinning of most of these issues. A third is transportation, because for a lot of people, getting to and from their places of employment, the places where they're getting education, getting their kids to and from school or childcare, or simply getting to and from the places where they have to go to get some of these services, is an issue. The fourth is technology, and that falls actually under two categories, the first of which is the things we've talked about, the information systems that we're using, and the second of which is how do we start to adapt the way we deliver services to reflect changes in technology and how people use technology. Most of us carry around something that looks like this iPhone, right? It's a smartphone. We use it a lot, and especially the younger generations are using them a lot, and should we be insisting on face-to-face services as the best way to deliver it, or can we develop new modalities, new ways of doing this that take advantage of technology while still protecting confidentiality and improving access? There are some other categories, but basically the plan at this point, Madam Chair, is to have a series of themed meetings. We will be meeting on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 1 to 3 p.m., with the exception of the fourth Thursday in March, which is the beginning of, which is during spring break, through June, and having these themed meetings and starting to really tease apart what the issues are. We've asked people to give us as specific examples as possible, which is to say, don't just tell me that there's this policy that says that people getting housing support can't do this or can't do that. I want to see a written copy of the policy or the OAR or the statute or the federal regulation, because until we can wrap our minds around what's really going on and get as specific as possible, it's going to be hard for us to know where the low-hanging fruit is so that we can start to make some quick interventions to fix some of these problems. Additionally, we're setting up a website. DAS is setting up a website for the task force. We'll be able to keep all the documents, because obviously we want them to be available to the public so people are aware of what we're doing and thinking about and have the opportunity to contribute more. Thanks to a suggestion from one of the groups, from Mr. John Mullen, whom you know, we have a public comment period at the end of every meeting so that people who aren't members of the task force have an opportunity to contribute. We've also established a very large mailing list of people who are interested, and certainly anybody listening to this hearing is welcome to contact Sandy or my office to get their name on that mailing list so that they can be apprised of meetings, make sure that they know what's going on. And we're soliciting input from the general public as well as members of the task force. Ultimately, certainly by the hearing legislative days in May, possibly by then, but certainly by September, we will have a much clearer sense of some places where we can sort of the general categories, some very specific examples of these categories, and places we can start to make changes, either from a policy or rule perspective, or if necessary, with statutory change that starts to break down a lot of these barriers. We do not anticipate that we'll be able to solve this problem in one fell swoop. And I don't think anybody thought that we could. But we do think that by starting to have these conversations, we're already seeing some people have some of those really good interactions that lead us to that. And I apologize, Senator, that was longer than 2 minutes, but hopefully it was reasonably concise.
It was very informed, though.
Thank you, sir.
Good stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Are you touching at all on the brick-and-mortar issues?
To some extent, yes, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we are. We've had some interesting conversations already about co-location, for example, of services. Mm-hmm. And many of us believe that co-locating a lot of these services is a good idea. However, Ms. Day from Child Welfare pointed out that they tried this in the past, and there are some interesting perceptions about who gets what kinds of services and whether people are willing to be in the same office as people who are getting other kinds of services, which we need to explore a little bit further to try to understand what's going on. But yes, we are definitely touching on brick and mortar issues.
One aspect of it you might want to consider is the potential logistical nightmare. For example, they have been attempting to do a co-location of services in Grants Pass, and they're going on 3 years now and still haven't broke ground. And I know, like in the Roseburg area, they are in the process of sending out an RFI on doing something similar. So there are some land use and other logistical issues that might want to be considered as we do that. And I would agree that maybe not all services should be together, but there are some that it does make sense.
Completely agree, Senator. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And colleagues, there are some informational hearings, and did you bring that list?
What I thought we had.
We have a report from DOJ, which I think can be done in May.
Yeah, that's.
We have
State Hospital.
The Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board's annual report, if you would like to hear that either Tuesday or Thursday, we can do that, or we'll hear it in May.
May.
Madam Chair, as we've had conversations, getting those reports in May, I think, would be appropriate. I think some of us could use this time to be looking for other things. I mean, now clearly will be the time to start building the 15 agenda.
That's
so.
Right. Well, I did hear a very interesting informational hearing that the House had today on microwaves and the possible association with autism. A lot of studies not being done here. We have, I think, a very solid, powerful industry. Anyway, it was really, really an eye-opener on the iPads and are coming on, and the screening of microwaves and the impact of MiFi. Some schools in Europe now have seen the effects from based on science of the effects on the children. They are making changes. Anyway, I'm all into prevention, and the more information we get out there, I think I would love to have that at some point. That informational hearing also, just to put it on your radar screen. I think with the new iPads just being on, what, a year now or 2 years, we haven't had them very long, and they're finding that some of the there isn't enough shield protection that because we just don't have the information on the impact of that. So things that maybe I would like, that I am very interested in the future, and I hope to get the information so that we can have an information hearing. Senator Cruz.
I just say I know for a fact there's a direct connection between microwaves and a bag of popcorn in 3 minutes, but
correlation is not causation.
Well, that's right. being a biologist and in doing research before I became a nurse, this is an area that's very interested. I'm very interested in. So please stay tuned. I can't guarantee there won't be an informational popping up between now and sign a die, but I expect it's the sign a die for sure next week. Hopefully the early part of the week, yes. But it'd be nice to sign a die early. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, committee. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, committee.